Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Worsham. With us again is the one, the only Dr. J, our very own stand-up pediatrician. How are you on this fine day, Dr. J?
Great, and great to be here talking to you again, my friend.
We were supposed to record a week ago, but you ran into some weather. Evidently, there is winter still happening over in the Connecticut way.
Yeah, we got about two feet of snow between like 4 a.m. Tuesday and like 5 p.m. Tuesday. It was like 12 hours, and it just snowed like 2 inches an hour. It was unbelievable.
We also have experienced what is the equivalent of a Southern California blizzard, which is a light dusting of rain in the morning. We've had heavy rain in the past month, but this last weekend we had some rain in the middle of the week, and I'm coaching my son's flag football team. And the coach is out of town for spring break, so daddy's running the practice. And I figure it's a drizzle. We're all going to go and practice. It's just a misting, if you would. And lots of moms were texting back. Dad's texting me saying, I'm sorry, my wife, you know, because so-and-so just got over a cold. And I wanted to get up on a Dr. J pulpit and say, the cold does not cause a cold. It is a virus. I've learned this from my very own friend.
That's right. Get them out in the rain, you know. Use your immune system, for Christ's sake.
All right, expend it. But am I right? I'm remembering
absolutely.
That correctly. It's not the cold.
And
I mean, it's the stress, maybe. Yes. And it would have been like maybe an hour. But anyway, speaking of, these are some great topics. Dr. J getting in on these awesome topics, by the way. And this is legislation that they're currently talking about here in my state of California. Mm-hmm. And that is, they are saying that research shows that kids need a later school start time. So I don't know what time the average school day starts in the East Coast area where you are?
In my area, most of the kids have to, you know, get up at 6, catch the bus around 6:30. School starts around 7, but they're out by, you know, 2:15.
See, our guys start at 8:15, and if kindergartners will go, if they start at 8:15, we'll be out at 11:40. So that's kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Who cares? First grade goes from 8:15 and goes until about 2:10. That's first and second. And then third grade starts at 8:15 and goes till 2:40. And then I feel like it kind of stays that way all the way through. I remember having to be at school at 7 a.m. in Northern California back in the day.
Yep.
And I had a paper out. But the part about this is because they, you know, we hear about it. I don't know if it's a big deal also where you are, but kids falling asleep in school. And the old story was it's because moms and dads aren't regulating or paying attention to their kids enough. And so they are letting the kids stay up way too late and they're not getting enough sleep. Now it seems that the bigger problem is packed extracurricular activities.
Yeah, and that's the reason that they can't start school later, because kids have jobs, kids play sports, and, you know, nowadays soccer is more important than Spanish, so I don't know what the priorities are there. How about the kids go to bed early, you know? I have problems with it because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that kids are into after school, and they need to socialize, too. I remember when I was in middle school, we had a fire at our school, so we had to go half days at the other middle school on the other side of town. They went in the morning. We didn't start until 1 o'clock, but we didn't get out till 5:30. And I can tell you from personal experience, that sucks.
So later isn't always better.
Yeah, I mean, and then you get home at 5:30, you eat, you have no time for homework. Yeah, I'm going to get up early because I don't have to go into 1:30 to do my homework in the morning. That's not going to happen. So, you know, and then there's kids that play hockey that got to be to the ice rink at 5 in the morning. So,
really?
I mean,
on a school day?
Yeah, the high school hockey team, they practice when they can get ice time because, you know, our high school doesn't have its own rink. So, you know, they get up, they go to the rink. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that's parents driving them. Then they got to shower and go to school the rest of the day. And then there could be a hockey game in the afternoon.
Yeah, and this is all the idea of these extracurricular activities. And I don't know, you're obviously a college educated guy, but the problem asking you is that I think we don't have the opposite side. I think you and I are very old school minded. Right. And there's this idea that the kids are doing these extracurricular sports for college. It looks good on a college application.
True.
And I have a skewed perspective on this. So if you're listening and you go, nope, you're full of shit, Justin, please send me an email because I would like to hear a different side of this. But here's how I got into college. I had horrible grades in high school. By horrible, I mean I had a D in English and math my junior year. The rest of the time I did pretty good. Early on, I was really good. And then I found vaginas and lost track. I lost the way. I started doing plays and yada, yada, yada. So it happened. So I got into college, though, because I was putting in a lighting system, a theatrical lighting system at an improv theater company I was working at, Comedy Sports in San Jose, and I needed some help with a lighting plot. And I knew there were some improvisers that were in the group that were studying at San Jose State. And I go, hey, am I right with this lighting plot, the way I'm putting this together? And this girl looked at it. She was like, you know, you should talk to the lighting designer at our school. So I said, okay. So I go in there with my binder sheet and I show it to him. And he's like, you did this. I said, yeah. He goes, how did you know to make it this way? I go, well, I'd seen lighting plots at jobs I'd had at a theme park and yada, yada, yada. And he goes, where are you going to school? Do you want to go to school? And I said, I want to, but I got denied applications because I got a D in English and math. And he goes, if I get you into school, will you study technical theater? Now, to me, what that really is that you, I don't necessarily think that this can be shown because your kid got up at 5 o'clock in the same way, I guess, right. Got up at 5 o'clock and went in hockey is it shows moxie. You know what I mean? It shows right. A little bit of oomph that you're putting into it. Do colleges really care? I mean, you put kids through college already. Do all of these extra sports and everything really help that much?
I mean, only if you're good enough to get money out of it, I think. You know, I did a checkup on a 18-year-old patient of mine the other day, and, you know, he's getting 4, you know, years of college for free to play baseball. I mean, not everybody gets that, yeah. But, I mean, that's the hope, you know, that the kid will be either smart enough to get scholarship money or athletic enough to get scholarship money because they're expensive.
And it's not like – so the reality is it's hard for the parent to sit like my boys are playing flag football. And when I look at my older son, I'm like, man, that kid could really throw the ball. He's got a nice form. He's got a good spiral. He gets it where he's throwing it. And he's only in second grade. I'm like, but I'm also not sitting there going, I'm going to Tiger Woods this kid and we're going to be doing drills. I'm not going to Todd Marinovich him and ruin his childhood over it.
Right.
I feel like the healthiest way to go about this is that if your kid is passionate about hockey and wants to get up at 5 a.m. to go do hockey, then you do hockey, but then you also ditch soccer. Unless you have that kid.
And we're talking high school kids, too. We're not talking, you know, little kids. This is something that they have a say in, you know, as to whether they want to participate, whether it's important to them or not. And a lot of kids, this is their ticket to going to a better college. So, you know, you can't take all that away. But again, they'd have to really restructure the whole entire school day if that's the case. Not to mention the chaos it would cause with the buses if everyone's going in late. You know what I'm saying? It's only so many buses. That's another reason that things start at different times. So it would really mess with what people have become accustomed to. Even starting, you know, high school at 8:30 instead of 7:30 will raise chaos if they're in school till 4.
Yeah, because everything then because you're saying that the school buses that are taking the kids home are more likely to run into heavier traffic if they're leaving at a 4 o'clock.
No, and right? I'm just saying that there's so many kids, at least in my town, that have to be bused. I mean, we have 5 elementary schools. They start at 3 different times just so that they can use the same buses to pick everyone up and drop everybody off. Hmm.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics released a policy statement in 2014 advocating a start time of 8:30 a.m. Yep. or later. In your experience, because here's the thing. Sometimes I feel like we as a people, not even just as Americans, but people, we look at things like this and we find the wrong solution to the problem. And it seems like a later start time could be a good thing, but I think that it's a symptom to a different problem. The problem is that you have kids and parents who are overly freaking out about what their kids are doing. Like a lot of parents are living vicariously through their kids. And so they want them to do all these extracurricular things because they couldn't do them when they were in high school, probably, or maybe even younger. And then you have the parents who are pushing their kids academically because you have to have a well-rounded application in order to get into a good school. And I just, I don't know. I feel like I'm unfairly biased, but I just don't see how, whether or not I go to Stanford or Cal State Stanislaus here in California, I don't know that my level of happiness is going to be that much different.
Right. And the other part is, do you think that, you know, letting high school kids go to school an hour and a half, 2 hours later, they're going to go to bed at the same time that they would for 6 a.m. And, you know, they're going to end up getting the same number of hours of sleep anyhow, you know, whether they're in bed at, you know, 9 to get up at 6 or they're in bed at 11 to get up at 8. So it's you know, then they can stay later at work the night before because I don't have to get up until 7:30 to go to school. I don't see them taking advantage of it.
Do you feel like a lot of kids are getting a lot more homework today than what they used to? And I'm talking about even in elementary. Like my son has to read for a half hour every day after school, which I'm not against. It just seems like as a parent, I feel like as a kid, I had a lot more time just to fuck around, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, but I think starting in like third grade, they really start piling on the homework, and you know, you've got reading and math sheets to do and spelling words to study, and then maybe you got like a little project that you got 2 weeks to work on, but you gotta, you know, budget your time. I do, and I think that with, you know, kids having multiple activities in addition to that, it's you know, it causes you to take the eye off the ball, which is their job is to, you know, go to school and learn and get smart because, you know, it doesn't just happen because you're there.
Have you seen any situation where I feel like my kids do? I have one son who does piano. They both do a hip hop class and then they both are doing flag football. And that's so 4 nights a week. I apologize. 5 if you count the game. So we got practice on Mondays and Tuesdays from 6 to 7:30. They love it. And I think it's great because it's getting them outdoors and they're running around.
Yep.
Thursday, he's got a half hour of piano. And what that comes with is about 10 to 15 minutes every other day of practicing piano because he's got a pretty good aptitude. Friday, they do from 5:30 to 6:30. They do a hip hop class, which is, I think, again, getting them mobile, getting them around, getting coordinated. And then Sunday, they have an hour-long game that they play. I feel like that's the max that I should be asking my kid to do as far as extracurricular activities. And that at this point, if they came to me and said, I want to also do this, then I feel like I need to be a parent and teach them the lesson of prioritizing things.
Right.
I mean, because it also at a certain point becomes what is economically feasible for us. I mean, I want my kids to have all the opportunities that they could possibly do, but I don't know. Do you think I'm looking at this wrong or?
No, I think that you have a well-balanced thing. It's multidisciplined. It's not all sports. It's not all academics. And, you know, your kids are younger, so that over time they're going to get – your job at this point is to expose them to a bunch of different things and, you know, see what sticks and what they're more interested in so that they can, you know, take it more seriously as they get older. And I don't think, you know, an hour, you know, even if it is 4 or 5 days a week to do something that isn't homework, isn't school, and is fun that they enjoy, I mean, I don't think that that's too much. I think that's probably right around where you want to be.
And my son already said, the older one said, that I think after I do my recital in June, I don't want to do piano anymore. And to be honest, I'm kind of bummed. And my dad is kind of pushing him to keep after it because my dad wishes he would have stuck with an instrument. He's going to be 60 this year and he's still trying to play a guitar. But I don't have that in me. I don't have that desire to push him. If he says I don't want to do it, I go, fine, I don't want to pay for it. So this is mutually beneficial to both of us.
Does he have natural inborn skills, though?
Where
you feel you need to nudge him a little sometimes?
Here's the thing. I think,
I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Please do. Anytime. I like it. Is that this is going to make me sound wild.
Because if he has no talent, then just say the hell with it.
This is going to make me sound wildly arrogant. But I think it really does apply to all people. I think that there are things that you have a natural aptitude for. But
right.
I very rarely... you're talking to a guy who pursued comedy for a living, talking to a guy who pursues comedy for a living. Like,
both nitwits.
Yeah, right? Is that there? I don't know how to put it, but very rarely have I seen an instance where somebody is uber passionate about something and they don't excel at it. And so I honestly think that, sure, is my son Mozart? No. But if he applies himself, does he pick up on it quickly? Yes. But I think it's because he has an interest and applies himself. So is it, I honestly, we always have had a rule since he started piano is that we pay for the by the month. And they have a rule that you can't cancel without giving like a 3 weeks notice. So we just made a blanket statement, said, okay, Jacob, if you decide you're going to quit, you have to finish a month because that's what we've paid for. And then you can be done. And he's done it before where he says, I think I'm going to quit. I don't want to do it. And it's just because he didn't want to deal with the hassle of practicing. But then, of course, he goes, he talks to the teacher, he has a class, and there's some little nugget of achievement that triggers that little endorphin release in his brain or dopamine, whatever it really is. And he loves it again when he comes out. So we've been dealing with that for 2 years now. But it's not like he's sitting in his room orchestrating songs, you know, or anything right. like that. There is no, he's not Prince who's now going, he's not picking up a guitar and applying things without any kind of lesson. So I think he's just a normal kid. That's my impression.
Yeah. And you know what though? You learn the piano, you learn how to read music, then it might be another instrument that he gets exposed to that he was meant to play. So, right. You know, there is that, if you introduce things early, they can, you know, kind of fall to the wayside for a little bit only to get picked up later. So, you know. Nothing wrong with exposing kids to a bunch of different things. I think, you know, if you got a 7-year-old who's just playing soccer 4 seasons a year, I think that's the wrong way to go.
Ah, yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's take a break and then let's get into a topic that is even more in your area of expertise, illness.
Sure.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. There's two articles that I think you found one, or you might have found everything for today's show. If I can, I don't even know if I remember.
There were a couple last time that I sent over to you. Yeah.
So, but you said these are kind of connected. So we're going to combine these two ideas and talk about them for these last two breaks. There's frequent illnesses, signs of a compromised immune system, and whether or not children should get their tonsils out. Which avenue do you want to walk down first as we break this down?
I think the frequent illness one is a good one to start with.
Now, what I like about this is this kind of like statement, and because I do think this is an interesting number, and I find it very shocking. The average.
I have been saying this to parents, and I'm so glad to see it in writing some other doctor. I almost say it word for word what this guy has here about kids because, yeah, they get sick all the time, especially when they're, you know, the year they enter the gen pop, as I like to call
yes,
it,
yes.
Whether it's daycare or kindergarten, they get walloped with everything that's out there. So read the statement because I say this all the time.
The average child experiences between 6 to 10 viral upper respiratory infections a year. I'm going to repeat that. 6 to 10 upper respiratory infections a year. The average duration of each cold is 7 to 14 days. So it could be at most 140. I'm breaking off what he says here, but 140 days. That means on average, infants and toddlers can be sick for 4 to 6 months each year. Statistically, this means that 50% of children will be sick more than this. Parents, you're not imagining things when you think your kids are sick all the time. Sometimes they are, and that's not abnormal. I find that really shocking. That does seem like a lot.
Now, I see our season here starts, you know, when they go back to school in September and then picks up in November. And then it doesn't slow down until, you know, kids start playing outside and they can open the windows at school and, you know, turn the heat off in the house. And that's like the middle of April. So, you know, September to April, I've been telling parents kids get, you know, 8 to 10 viral illnesses, some of which are just going to be colds that last a week. You get the fever the first couple days, the runny nose, the cough, and then they, you know, get better. And some, because, you know, some kids don't clear things as well, are going to settle in the chest, settle in the ears, settle in the sinuses. And those are the kids that, you know, come in around day 5 or 6 or 7 of a cold. And, you know, now they have a fever and they're not sleeping at night and they're pulling on their ears. So even if, you know, a kid gets, you know, an ear infection with half of those colds, you're still talking maybe 4 ear infections over 7-8 months. So it's, you know, it's a sizable burden.
And the next question in this, which is kind of the question I wanted to ask you, is that if it's normal for kids to be sick most of the year, when should parents worry about their child's immune system and whether or not it's working as well as it should be?
Well, I mean, if they're catching things that are unusual, everybody more or less, it's the same viruses they catch, the same bacteria causing ear infections and sinus infections. But, there are things that can demonstrate a weakened immune system. For instance, little babies get thrush, which is the fungal infection of the inside of the mouth, the white cheesy stuff they can get on their tongue and their cheeks and stuff. And it's normal in babies. It's not normal in older kids. And that can be a sign that their immune system isn't keeping things in check. Kids who, are sick all the time and don't gain weight. I mean, most kids are going to, eat and drink pretty well through their colds. But, kids who, fail to gain weight, kids who are showing delays in their milestones, if there's a family history of any kind of rare immunological things. I mean, all that stuff you gotta pull together. And, some kids fit the mold for, having an immune deficiency. It's very uncommon. I mean, I have a practice of about 5,000 kids, and I think we have 3 kids in the practice that have some kind of an acquired immunodeficiency. So it's not, real common, but what is real common is everybody catching stuff when they enter the Gen Pop and then being able to, pick through all those kids who just have colds and be able to identify the outlier that isn't handling it quite as well as he should. So, that's really part of our job as the doctors. The states have their newborn screening programs, and one of the things they do screen for in most states, I think almost all of them, is the SCIDs, the severe combined immune deficiency. And it's rare, but if you know that it's there early on, then which kids have to be jumped on quickly and who needs to be referred to an immunologist, and who needs to, you don't wait till the eardrum ruptures. These kids need to get started on stuff right away. But, for the most part, kids who get strange infections, and just as an aside, the kids who, it's pretty normal to get ear infections when you have colds and congestion throughout the winter months. But when you continue to get ear infections when the colds aren't around anymore, like May and June and July, those are kids who probably have some kind of drainage problem in their ears, and they should probably be the ones that get tubes. Whereas if you have 3 or 4 between September and April, well, that's kind of just part of life, I guess. If you're going to have 6 to 10 upper respiratory infections, yes, kids under 5 don't drain well, and some of them are going to get a lot of ear infections, which leads to antibiotic use, and it goes right down the rabbit hole. But the kids that continue to get the infections that you expect certain times a year, and they keep occurring even in the months where you're not seeing it in the majority of other kids, those outliers may have either a anatomic or, drainage problem with their Eustachian tubes, or maybe it is that they have some kind of an immune problem. So
you're saying if you're saying if you see a sickness in your kid that isn't a result of the bug going around, in a sense, a viral version
season,
of rice,
or
life.
They get something that's odd for the time of year, or get a particular bacterial infection that's just, one of the ones that you don't commonly see. Those are the ones that you have to think about. And now, it's nice that at least in Connecticut, they screen for primary immunodeficiencies in newborns, so that, you kind of have a little heads up there too.
Well, it says here that there are 2 main types of immune deficiency. There's the first, which is called secondary or acquired, and this is related to cancer or HIV, where the child is fighting a larger illness, and that fight causes their immune system to be weakened, that's unrelated to what they're talking about here. The other one is primary immunodeficiencies, or PID, is that correct, or PID?
Yep, they don't make enough of the immunoglobulins so that they they don't build up any kind of long-term protection. These kids, we give them their primary series of vaccines, and they never convert. You do a blood test on them, after they've had their 2, 4, and 6 month vaccines, and they haven't developed any kind of a response to it. So not only, is that a problem, but now they're you know, at risk for those particular diseases that everyone else is immunized against. So another reason for people to all immunize everybody, because some of these kids don't develop a response. You know, it's rare, but, you know, your kid goes to school and he has a primary immunodeficiency and he's gotten the shots, but his blood and body doesn't know it. And then you have someone who hasn't immunized their kid sitting next to him, and you know, that's the problem. Kids go to, you know, elementary school while they're getting treated with chemotherapy. You know, we need to make the schools as healthy as possible, not just for all the kids, but certain populations of kids who are going through, you know, treatment and can't afford to catch pertussis or be exposed to the measles or things like that.
Interesting point you bring up here, Doc, is that what I'm hearing you say is that we have more of a sensitivity to a child having a peanut allergy than what we do to a child who's got an actual immune system problem. Like, I find it that we have these arguments about vaccinations, and some people have religious beliefs that they don't want to have the kid vaccinated and everything like that. So, I mean, obviously, the first answer is there are more kids now who are allergic to peanuts or tree nuts, right, than there are kids who suffer from this PID, which is, it says here, about 0.0087% of the population has any one of 180 different PIDs. That works out to be one out of 1,200 people. So I don't know how many, it seems like a lot, but I don't know how many kids are allergic to nuts out of, say, 1,000. It looks like.
And did you see now they have to add to the smoothies to give you more protein? They've got a powdered peanut now, powdered peanut you can add to your smoothies.
And that's, I mean, all hypoallergenic,
we got to do is aerosolize that shit. We can knock out a third of an elementary school.
So it isn't hypoallergenic at all. We just crop dust it and watch them drop like flies.
Look for big purchases of peanut powder in Yemen, okay? Be on high alert.
Oh, that is dark but very funny.
I know. I had to say it. I'm sorry.
All right. Let's take another quick break and come back and connect this back to tonsil ectomies, yeah?
Yep.
So this is a thing where I feel like a lot of parents, I feel like a lot of kids, here's where I know tonsillectomies, sitcoms. I feel like there's always a sitcom where somebody's having their tonsils removed, and it's maybe it's because that little kid, they, you know, is negotiating a contract or something, and so therefore they just need them to be there, but they can't say any words because then they don't have to pay them. I don't know, but I feel like you talk to mostly adults like, oh, I've had my tonsils out, and it was great because I got to have ice cream. I remember that, having a lot of junior high conversations with my friends who had their tonsils removed. I did not have mine removed, but do you do a lot of these? I don't know if you even do them as a pediatrician.
I don't do them. No. Okay. No, we send them to ear, nose, and throat doctors. But, you know, it's not a common practice. I mean, most of the time, I'd say the main reason that they take them out now is for kids whose tonsils interfere with sleeping and, you know, obstructive sleep apnea problems because of enlarged tonsils or enlarged adenoids can, you know, cause problems with oxygenation, can stress the heart in certain conditions. And, you know, that's probably the main reason that they take them out. Kids who have big tonsils that constantly are catching one infection after another strep throat infection, sometimes those that's another reason. And then the last reason is that the kid just can't swallow a piece of food past them because they're big and they're like big meatballs back there.
Wow.
Obstructing him with, you know, your tonsils should get big when you're sick, fight infection, and then they should get smaller when you're feeling better. And when the kids have big tonsils all the time and they flop back there obstruct their airway, you know, in kids, most of them get their tonsils out, and, you know, fat shits like me and, you know, other adults, they throw a CPAP mask on us and blow our tonsils up so that we can get air. And so But those three reasons, I think, are the primary reasons for it. And I think, you know, the main one is the sleep apnea problems, the snoring, the noisy breathing, kids that don't get a good night of sleep. So, you know, they get a shitty night of sleep. It doesn't matter what time school starts in the morning. So, you know, and the tonsils, I mean, they're not just there for decoration and causing problems. I mean, when something enters your body through the mouth, they're lymph tissue, and they're the, you know, the first part of the immune system that recognizes is that something's got into the body and activates the immune system.
So yeah, it seems like
they're just hanging around. They do serve a purpose, but when they become a problem, you know, you weigh the risk, the benefits, and you know, you decide to take them out. And most kids' tonsils do get smaller after 9, and that's primarily because they've seen most of the viruses and infections, and you know, they have some protection against them. They don't get sick as much.
Yeah, they seem like the intake filter on your air conditioning system. Like they catch it, and then they know, and then they can send a message going, "Hey, here's what's just got in. Let's go find it elsewhere." Yeah,
exactly right.
Here's my other question.
Why, you know, they don't like to jump at taking them out because they do play a role.
You've been doing pediatrics for over 25 years. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah.
All right. So it says here, 30 years ago, 90% of tonsillectomies in children were done because of reoccurring infections. Now, right, only 20% are infections. 80% are what you described, obstructive sleep problems. So do you feel like were you suggesting a lot of kids remove their tonsils when you first started practicing? And then was it just studies that come out, journals, like what you found out about the fact that we weren't giving 5 and 6 months old kids peanuts is kind of what created the trend of, is that what happens? Is over time you just start realizing, oh,
it's just
this
more
doesn't
studies,
stop infections.
You know, and our studies in pediatrics aren't always the same as what the ear, nose, and throat guys, literature comes to conclusions on. So it does change from time to time. But I'd say that those three reasons have been, you know, the three reasons that have always, been why I've referred. And I think that, you know, by the time I'm ready to send someone to an ENT, I'm not looking for him to give me his opinion. I'm just looking for him to take them out. The time's up, right, you know. And sometimes they bounce them back and they'll try some other things and, and they don't do it. But I would say that, you know, the sleep apnea part, I mean, I've had kids that have had changes in their EKG because their heart is stressed by obstructive tonsils. So, I mean, when you're seeing the trickle down effect of other organs having issues because you got big tonsils, I mean, that's a no brainer.
Yeah. And how much of this sleeping problems, because you mentioned like a CPAP, how much of this is related to child obesity?
There's a large portion of it, but you know, the problem with obesity isn't the tonsils.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, the flopping down of the fat pads, and you know, the kids with, say, for instance, Down syndrome, a lot of them have extra neck fat pads, and they have a lot of problems with sleep apnea. And they're, I would say, you know, largely, large majority of them, because the tonsils are back there, but not they're not the reason that they're having sleep problems. They do take out a lot of tonsils because they have other reasons to have sleep problems.
One of the questions that I noticed, and I can't remember which one of these articles it was, but I want to talk to you about, is that the doctor is basically saying that, you know, I have parents of my patients that come in and they want to give me a breakdown of every aspect of illness and behavior change in hopes that they, out of fear that they will miss some kind of detail that I will need. And sometimes they get frustrated because I just kind of interrupt them and keep asking them the same kinds of questions.
I tell the parents, I'm not Dr. House.
You're not. And is it because I can imagine as a parent, I want to give you all the information I can think of.
Right.
But does it really, like 80, 90, even more percentage of the people coming through there are coming through there for the same exact thing?
That's part of it. Plus, there's certain things that are important in the history. And if they let me go through my process and ask the questions and answer the question and then go on to the next one, I get a clearer picture of what I'm dealing with. When they come in with a loose leaf binder with multiple pages of statistics and, you know, weight in grams of each bowel movement the child's had for the last week, I mean, the graphs and the checklists, it's a little overwhelming for me to deal with that in a 15-minute office visit.
See, that's interesting because whenever my sons have a checkup, my wife wants me, there's always something. Like, for instance, I can't remember the name of it. I think it's a fibroid or something. Is that my son has a little lump on the left side of his neck, kind of near where his jugular would be. Mm-hmm. And we've had it measured. We've had it scanned when he was very, very young. And the doctor said, I think it's just a fibroid. Or what does that sound right to you?
Fibroma.
Fibroma, yeah. And so she feels it. And, like, especially when he was really, really young, they just want to make sure it wasn't growing. Because, of course, as parents, we're like, oh, my God, it's a tumor. My child right. has a tumor on his neck. And we were kind of freaking out. Even, to be honest, me to a certain extent. I mean, I was okay because yeah. I felt like we caught it early and I didn't know. So I was leaning on the fact that you're ignorant, which means you're going to freak out much faster. Let the people who know this shit and who you trust to handle this shit for you take care of it and tell you when you should freak out. And very rarely does freaking out ever help. So now my wife, though, every time he has a checkup, she makes me ask the pediatrician, is the lump getting bigger? You know what I mean?
He should also have it in the chart himself and
right,
know
she
to
does.
Check that with every checkup. So, you know, and I know from kid to kid, you know, you get to know parents and what their styles are, and they get to know what my style is, and we all kind of, you know, settle into a middle ground. It's the young ones. It's the 20 somethings having babies now that are very, you know, ill equipped for the job at hand.
Really?
I mean, well, you know what? They think they know everything, and you think you're having a conversation with someone that understands, and then they refer to their kid's belly button as the umbilical cord, and you know that there's just not much going on up there.
Well, it's my father's theory is that you should not have kids when you get older. Like, he feels like 30 is the sweet spot, but if you could go yep. younger, it's better because you're too dumb to overthink it and to screw the kid up. That's his theory.
Right.
It's right. almost like
we all screw up the first kid.
Right.
All right. Because we don't know what the hell we're doing.
Well,
and we got to apologize the rest of our lives for that.
I feel like he's saying neglect is better than overparenting. That is, I think that's a fair way. Would you, I mean, I know that we joke around on this show a lot, but would you, in your experience, you know, obviously we're not saying, hey, everybody, just leave your kids at home and go out on a date night, even though they're 4 years old. But it's just saying, in your experience, it, very rarely has somebody missed something or, you know, by... It's not, you know what I mean? It is a fine line. You don't want to be.
It's so hard to say. There are so many times that I look at my schedule and I see that the reason someone's bringing in their kid and I roll my eyes. And then when I examine the kid and I see what's going on and I say, you know what? I'm really glad you called right. to bring him in today, you know, and that we didn't just, you know, blow this off. So it's so hard to say. And I thank God that I have like a sixth sense that, you know, if anything, I can identify a very sick kid or a kid who's got something going on because I have that huge denominator of so many well kids that I've seen over 25 years that when there's somebody who's really sick and is an outlier, you know, it jumps out at me, you know, as a doctor that sees mostly well kids all day.
These hypochondriac parents are actually saving lives of other kids because they're bringing kids that look normal.
But they're also, you know, the boy that cried wolf too, because then you have a tendency to say, oh, it's them calling again, you know, and then you miss something. So it's a tough line to draw there. I don't have a good answer for that. It's, you know, part of it is just the feeling I'm getting when I'm talking to them on the phone is to, you know, or they say one thing that makes me think, well, geez, it could be this. And, you know, sometimes parents are in at the very first sign of a clear droplet of clear stuff coming out of one nostril. Okay. And then there's other parents that sometimes, quite frankly, wait too long to bring their kids in. So I wish it was a perfect science. It isn't. So I just, you know, I tell them, here's what's going on today. And then I say, this is what I think is going to happen over the next couple days. If that doesn't happen, or this, that, or the other thing happens, then, you know, I want you to bring them back in a couple days. Things evolve. So, It really is just you have to have a good dialogue and a good relationship with your kid's doctor and get a feel for each other. And, you know, some like me, I'm very nurturing, believe it or not. Although, you know, when they start crying, I got a little issue with that. I hand a mom a tissue. You know, that's one thing. If I hand you the box, it's time to wrap up the crying. Okay. I got work to do here. So, but yeah, I mean, we're dealing with people's kids and, you know, you have to, I tell parents there are no dumb questions. I mean, that's a lie because half of my comedy act is littered with those dumb questions.
But that's why you say there are no, because at least it serves a purpose either way.
But if it's something that they're concerned about their kid, because everybody's different, you know, if it's important to them, you know, you got to do it. I had a mom in the other day. She was concerned about a little lymph node on the baby, you know, but then, you know, she had Hodgkin's lymphoma when she was 14. So, yeah, she's going to be a little more concerned about a lymph node in her kid's neck than someone else. So everybody brings with them their own anxieties and baggage and stuff. And, you know, my job is really just to do what's best for the kid. I'm not going to encourage someone to have surgery on a kid that doesn't need it. I'm going to do my best to tell them why I wouldn't do that. You know, you want to do no harm, but you also have to understand where people are coming from. And maybe for another episode, I mean, this goes back probably 15 years, but I had to deal with a mom in my practice who was a Munchausen's by proxy, and I had to go to court.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it's amazing what you know what happens. And like I said, every time I walk into an exam room, I have no idea what's gonna come up. Nothing, you know. And my job is to just try to, you know, answer things as best I can, and if I don't have the answers, send them to a place where they can get the answers. But, you know, it's a mixed bag. And that's why it's interesting. You know, I mean, if all I saw was checkups all day and gave shots, it wouldn't be very challenging, you know. But, you know, and you have to have a certain personality to be able to deal with parents who are out of their mind, scared that something's wrong with their kids.
Yeah. Here's what I learned from this conversation with you today, and I always walk away with something, and it's one of the many reasons why I love you, is that I realize that my brain is wired to try to find the best and perfect way to do most things. I'm not super anal, but by me sitting there going, is there a right way to talk to the doctor? But there are so many variables, and it is so subjective that you can never really tell. There's no way to do it perfectly, so you just got to do with what go with what feels best, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm seeing a 15-year-old who's been healthy his whole life, and I'm looking at him coming up as my next checkup, I'm saying, all right, this one usually goes pretty well, and I can catch up here. And then you go in, and midway through the checkup, he you know, says that he's depressed. And then it takes a turn, and you hit a little. What do we call them? I call them speed bumps. Flow busters. Flow busters is the actual term, because I heard someone at the corporate office refer to those people as flow busters. But you know what? They're kids, and if they're feeling comfortable enough with me to tell me they're depressed, then I gotta just buck up and do what I have to do as the kid's doctor. And, you know, that's why sometimes doctors fall behind. I certainly don't overbook. I don't overbook. The only time I would fall behind is if something important comes up with another kid, or, you know, somebody is late, and just the domino effect of one person being 15 minutes late screws up a morning, screws up an afternoon. So go on time to your doctor.
There you go. There you go. All right. That was our show. If you have a question that you would like Dr. J to answer on the next show we do together in about a month, you could send it to either show at the dad podcast. Let me try that again. Show at the dad podcast.com or questions at the dad podcast.com. Either one goes the same place. So whatever's easier for you, I don't care. Don't forget to follow Dr. J on the Twitter. I have it here at Dr. J. His website is standuppediatrician.com. And I hope you don't mind, because I happen to click and go to your website. And if you were listening to this the week it came out, Saturday, April 1st, Dr. J is going to be at Comedy at the Club. And is that Umbridge or Unbridge or Uxbridge?
Unbridge.
Unbridge. Massachusetts. Yeah. So if you're going to, especially if you're in the Northeast area along the East coastline, if that's where you make your home, go to standuppediatrician.com, because you can actually see Dr. J do his hilarious stand up. I've seen it. I've seen it a lot.
And I'm opening for Pete Corielli the 20th to the 23rd, and Mark Norman the following weekend at the Hartford Funny Bone. So those will be fun too.
Please check those out, and please go up and say hi and tell him that you listened to the show. It is a great show. I can guarantee you. One time I politely asked him to come out here to Los Angeles and open for me, and he did and was awesome, and everybody loved him. So
best week of my life, and I got to meet Yakov Smirnoff.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about that. What a country. All right. So go to the dadpodcast.com. Down at the bottom of the page, there's an Amazon banner. If you click that, bookmark it for your Amazon banner, then every time you purchase something from the Amazon, Daddy gets about 5 to 10%, and it costs you nothing. Give us a like at facebook.com/dadpodcast. And if you are new to the show and or have not done this yet, you need to join the Facebook fan group. It's Staying Frosty with the Dad Podcast, run by our very own Butcher Drew.
All right.
And it's a great way to talk and chat with like-minded parents. I've gone by there, noticed that both of our experts, Dr. J and our sex and family therapist, Rachel Gibbs, will go in there too and chime in and chat with you guys. And that is very kind. I appreciate you for doing that, Dr. J. And I think that's it. So on behalf of the fantastic Dr. J, this is Josh Warsom saying hug your kids, hump your loved one, and stay frosty, my friends.